Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California, from Monday, July 28th, 2014. Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we will look at the presidential fundraising and presidential lawsuits situations, the immigration situation, Obamacare is back in the courts, California's death penalty recently had a ruling, and of course we'll have lots of election news to report and to discuss and dissect. We'll try to provide some insight into these issues. Any opinions expressed up here by any of us are just our opinions, not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for today. Starting on the far end there is C.W. Nevius, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Thank you. Thank you, Mom. I appreciate it.
You can follow him on Twitter at C.W. Nevius. Next to him, actually, in the middle there, is Melissa Griffin Kane. She's an attorney and a contributor to KPIX-TV and San Francisco Magazine. And you can follow her on Twitter at Mel Griffin Kane. And last, but certainly not least, Bill Whalen is a research fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Recently started a great election blog you might want to check out. It's called A Day at the Races. You can find it at hoover.org. So there are question cards that are distributed throughout the room. Please go ahead and write down and submit your questions. I'll do my best to ask as many as possible during the program. I might combine them if it makes sense and it will save us a little bit of time. But let's move on to our roundtable now. The first topic, and I believe we actually touched on this the last time we met, and that is the House GOP is suing President Obama over an element in his implementation of Obamacare, also known as, or actually, it's the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. A White House aide has said that it's a precursor to impeachment. So, Bill, I'm going to start with you. Why is the House doing this? Well, the House Republicans, I should say.
It's worth noting, for those of us who grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was a time in American politics when the Republicans were the presidential party in America, and the Democrats were the congressional party. And then in 1992, so this way for about 40 years, in 1992 things changed. And the Democrats became the presidential party, and the Republicans became the congressional party. When Barack Obama leaves office in 2017, Republicans will have had control of the House for 20 of the last 24 years. What happens is, with being the congressional party, and you see this in the 24 elections, how this plays out, a certain mindset kicks in, and it's very much an anti-executive mindset. You view the president as being excessive in powers. Democrats did this to Reagan, they did it to the first Bush and the second Bush, and now you see Republicans doing this to Obama, and that they have huge problems with executive powers. What's interesting here, and I'll defer to the lawyer on the panel about this, is in the case of Obamacare, in the case of executing the laws, there is a very much a black hole in the Constitution and in Washington as a result. And that is, if you think the president's not faithfully executing the laws, what do you do? Well, the answer is you say, we impeach him. But if you look at what qualifies for impeachment under the Constitution, it's what? It's treason, it's bribery, it's high crimes, and misdemeanors. Technically, not faithfully executing the law does not qualify under any of those. So what do you do as a member of Congress? You sue the president, which is what Boehner is trying to do and trying to get the House to go along. Now, this probably falls under the category of frivolous. Why? Odds of this going up to the Supreme Court, well, you have to get it through the various branches of the federal judiciary. And then the question is, if you get it all the way to the Supreme Court, what at the end of the day are you trying to prove? You can argue there is a political necessity here for Boehner that, number one, he is trying to gin up his base, just as the president is when he talks about impeachment, his folks are trying to gin up their base, he's trying to gin up his base. But secondly, I suspect the other political end here is that they feel that every day the president has to in some way talk about or defend health care, it's a good day for Republicans.
You know, one of the things that happened, which I don't know if you, I just noticed it the other day, is that the Heritage Foundation, which is an extremely conservative think tank, took a look at this lawsuit and said, you know, actually, I don't think this is a very good idea. You know, it's not going to, you have to prove harm. It's going to be very difficult to do it. There's been many instances when presidents have done this. But that's a little bit like one of the Kardashians saying, you know, instead of rushing into a relationship, I think you should get to know the person a little bit first, you know. And the Heritage Foundation says something like that. Our attorney, I'm sure, can explain this much better than I.
Okay, Melissa.
Who am I to correct a Kardashian metaphor? I think it's fantastic. No, I think it's absolutely correct. The at issue is this phrase, and he was making fun of me for having notes, but the phrase is important. In the Constitution, it says that the executive shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And what this lawsuit alleges, basically, is that the president, in extending the mandate for businesses to implement Obamacare, did not faithfully execute the law. And in truth, the law is pretty clear. It does say, you know, these provisions shall go into effect on December 31st. So it's not like there's a lot of, it's not like you could say, well, maybe that was ambiguous. Maybe there's wiggle room there. It's pretty clear. Having said that, I mean, your point is the critical one. It's whether there was harm. If someone gives you $100 and then you try to sue them, right, the judge is going to say, help me understand your problem here. And in this case, basically, John Boehner, for example, can't show necessarily that he has personally been harmed, that the institution has been harmed. There's a question about, you know, sort of who has standing there. Do you need somebody from the Senate as well? Is it just enough to have the House upset about this? So there's not just a black hole in terms of sort of how do you enforce this provision of the Constitution. There's a black hole in terms of jurisprudence about how a Congress would even go about suing the president, who has to show that they were actually affirmatively harmed by this. And so that's you know, a number of people disagree. There's plenty of disagreement on both sides of this. And right now, there's threats that they are going to move toward impeachment based on the president's statements that he's going to move unilaterally on immigration. And so now John Boehner is saying, well, you know, I've threatened this lawsuit, but if you move forward with immigration unilaterally, we're going to move straight to impeachment. And that's also causing a big rift in the Republican Party as well. But again, an issue in the lawsuit is really standing, is sort of the central one. Having said that, it will take years, as the wheels of justice move slowly. And so it will take years if this gets brought, let's assume it does, it'll take years for it to wind it through. Obama will not be in office anymore by the time this actually gets resolved. So it is a lot of theater. Democrats are kind of excited. They had their biggest day of fundraising of the year the other day when this came out. So they're not exactly, you know, fighting too hard against this. They think it helps their narrative that the Republicans are unreasonable and in their hatred of Barack Obama. So it's sort of playing out both for Republicans and Democrats in that way.
So what actually happens if, say, this goes before a judge, the judge rules, and the House GOP wins the case? Obama says, oops, or, I mean, it's not like...
It gets appealed.
Yeah, first of all, it gets appealed.
But I mean, the ultimate on it is still, say, after all the appeals...
Exactly. What is the remedy that you're seeking?
Right. But also, if this is the remedy, an attack on Obama, nothing happens to Obama.
Well, the remedy would be that you would somehow pay for the damages, again, difficult to prove, of the failure to enact the law as it was written. So whatever the damages you can estimate, again, this is all theater, but whatever the damages you could estimate between the date that the law was supposed to take effect and the date that it actually took effect, assuming you can find a small businessman or someone who can say that I was hurt by not having to do this. Good luck with that.
Yep.
Because the Republicans
actually would prefer it not be implemented at all. They don't like this part of the Correct. Obamacare in the first place. Right. I mean, two things. One is George Bush did something very similar in 2006 when he delayed the implementation for seniors to sign up for whatever it was, the medical health care plan.
Part D.
Yes. And second, Obama kind of had a make my day moment because when this was eventually made public, he went into the Rose Garden and issued about four more executive orders and said, if you like those, you're going to love these. So, I mean, this is not necessarily hurting Obama in a lot of ways, fundraising-wise or public relations-wise.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, related somewhat to that is more Obamacare news. Two conflicting federal court rulings. Did you see this on July 22nd? This regards the legality of subsidies for people who sign up for health care plans through the federal exchange. One court said it's illegal to do this. Another court said it's legal. So for you folks, does this matter? I mean, this is just headed straight back to the U.S. Supreme Court, right?
Right. Well, and we're in uncharted waters. Right. I mean, the idea that we've always talked about trying to find some kind of a health care plan that would work for all Americans. We don't know how it's going to work. There's been a lot of moving parts. We don't really we're making it up as we go, and this is all part of the deal. It's not unusual, I don't think, to have two judges have two different opinions about what it's going to be. It's going to be sorted out, and we'll figure out what it is. But I think to the disappointment of a lot of Republicans, Obamacare is maybe a little more popular than people thought.
Well, we often have lots of bad news for California on various political discussions like this. But, I mean, couldn't California get a pat on the back for having gotten an exchange set up, planned, and executed, being one of the first ones to do this?
Yeah.
You know, whether you like the plan or not, I mean, whether you like the ACA or not, I mean, California was there, and it has not had the problems that some of these other states are having.
Yeah, all six states.
Ironically, it's a Republican governor, actually.
That was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
But I think the courts can sort of just nickel and dime this ad nauseum. Yeah. I think the only thing that really changes the bigger equation is if in 2017 you have Republican Congress and Republican president, because then now Congress could actually repeal the law if they wanted to, and you'd actually have a president who would sign the repeal. Yeah.
Well, just to be specific about what the cases are about, and again, make fun of me because I got the language, because the language is really important. The language is important. It says that federal government will provide subsidies for insurance policies, quote, enrolled in through an exchange established by the state. Now, what that means in practical terms, at least from a literal reading necessarily of this, is that only state exchanges can get federal subsidies. So remember, there are federal exchanges that cover a lot of states, especially those with Republican governors who decided they did not want to create state exchanges. They're going to let the federal government sort of deal with it. And so what this would do is strip those subsidies out of those federally provided exchanges. And so one court said, the D.C. court said, well, we'd love to be creative with the language, but the language is pretty clear. It says state exchanges, so if you're not a state exchange, you don't get subsidies. Mm-hmm. We're not going to sort of monkey with the literal interpretation of the language. The Virginia Circuit Court said, throughout the language of the bill, which is super long, to be fair, throughout the language of the bill, they sort of use these terms interchangeably, state exchange, federal exchange. So you know what? We don't think that they meant to just limit it to state exchanges. And so that's why you have the sort of separate interpretations, basically, that it's going to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court eventually, but first it's going to go through the District Court of D.C. Now, practically speaking, it doesn't have a lot of impact. To your point, it'll be years down the road before we see any actual impact of the idea of the federal subsidies leaving the federal exchanges. However, as insurance plans try to plan for the future, we may see them maybe trying to raise their rates a little bit or try to react to what they anticipate. Because remember, they're looking 20 years down the road. They're not planning year to year. So as they sort of try to create their plans under the plan, they'll be looking to try and make a determination about whether they think those federal subsidies will be there down the line. So that's the practical implication, if there is one right now. Otherwise, it should be, again, it's going to be years, and it's going to depend on who's in Congress and that sort of thing. But that's the basis of this sort of split decision and why it's a big deal, because a lot of these states aren't like California. A lot of them didn't get it together, and they're relying on the federal subsidies heavily. So.
Well, very good. Let's kind of stick with... I'm sorry.
I like that. That was terrific. So smart.
We've all just learned... We're getting an undergraduate class here on legal boom. Or graduate.
Undergraduate?
Sorry. I wasn't jumping us all directly to our master's. Well, but let's stay with some legal stuff. And this is regarding the California death penalty. A federal judge ruled that the death penalty cannot be carried out. I don't know if it was specifically that it was unconstitutional, or if there were what the exact ruling was. So I'm actually going to go right back to Melissa.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Hi.
She's a lawyer. She's paid by the hour.
Don't
feel bad for her.
So this was really unique what the judge did here. It was a really big deal. You hear about death penalty cases all the time, but this one was a really big deal. This is the first time a judge said that the death penalty is arbitrary and capricious because of the system. Right? Sometimes they find it arbitrary and capricious because there's a problem with the drugs that are administered and things like that, the actual act of executing someone, but not here. Here, he said, it just takes too long. He said, appeals are fine. They're important. We're talking about killing people. This is important. But the way you do it in California is so messed up that it's just completely crazy. He says it takes, he cited studies, it was really alarming. He cited studies showing that it takes sometimes 8 years, 8 years to even get an attorney appointed to you when you're on death row for one of these appeals. The appeal happens and then the courts take 2 to 4 years to issue a decision. He says in the aggregate, it takes an average of 25 years. Once you're sentenced to death, 25 years to go through that appeals process. And he says at the end of 25 years, most people are dead from something else, right? sadly, suicide or old age, right? So the people who actually end up being executed are this sort of strange, arbitrary group of people. So he says, look, if the purpose of the death penalty is to deter crime and to make whole or exact revenge, basically, on behalf of the victims. He says this doesn't accomplish either because you can't predict with any certainty who's ever actually going to be executed, even when they've been convicted and they've been sentenced to death. So he says this whole process makes this arbitrary and capricious, and that's why it's unconstitutional, and this is the very first ruling of its kind. It's really groundbreaking.
Yeah. In my simple-minded way of thinking of it, the judge basically said you can't use the death penalty because you're not using the death penalty. He said in the 35 years since we passed the death penalty, 900 people have been sentenced to death. 13 have actually been executed. So it's cruel. He said it's cruel and unusual to leave these guys on death row and tell them it could happen any time, but you can't even get an attorney, you can't work the process. They're basically in this terrible limbo. And he said that's cruel and unusual. So that, to me, as a layman, not an attorney, that was kind of the basis, and it was interesting.
I think in Latin, his ruling was "use it or lose it."
There we go.
the political reaction has been really the follow-up from this has been fascinating. I find in 1992, Pete Wilson signed off on the execution of Robert Alton Harris. This was the first execution in literally a generation in California, and this was enormously controversial and enormously dramatic at the time, and it happened. And in the 1990s in California, there was a very potent lobby in the state called the Victims Lobby. These were Doris Tate, the mother of Sharon Tate, and various parents of children who'd fallen victim to crimes and so forth. They would come to the state capitol. They would put coffins on the lawn of the state capitol and crosses and so forth. And they were powerful. And so you just could not pass tough enough crimes to placate them. I have noticed the rather deafening silence that has come with this ruling. You don't hear the victims' lobby crying about this, complaining, threatening to go to the ballot or any sort of way. We have a governor's race, in case you haven't forgotten. It's easy to forget because it's never in the news. But we do have a governor's race, and you don't hear a peep out of the Republican candidate going after the Democratic governor who's been all over the map on the death penalty over the years. It's just really just vanished to a great extent from the radar screen of Californians.
Has the governor said anything about this, or do we know what his position is on it?
I would assume he'd be in favor of it. Jerry Brown, when he was a governor in the 70s and the 80s, had a rather conflicted view of the death penalty, which was that he was personally opposed to it as a good Catholic, but that he would not stand in the way of the law being carried out. He then appointed Supreme Court Justice and Rose Byrd, who would not carry it out. You remember what happened to Rose Byrd. She lost her seat, she was recalled by voters because of this. But no, I have not. If he's made any pronouncement of it, they've been buried in the papers. They're not to be seen.
Well, I think politically, too, there's another interesting question here. Remember with Proposition 8, what happened is that a federal judge, a lower court judge, said Prop 8 is unconstitutional. And Jerry Brown, who was the attorney general then, said, I'm good with that. I'm not going to appeal it. And that's when another group stepped in, and that's sort of what ended up in the Supreme Court. In this case, very similarly, Kamala Harris defended the law as it stands now, and she lost. And the question now is she going to appeal it? Remember, she's very much anti-death penalty. She caught a lot of flack as DA of San Francisco when she refused to seek the death penalty in some high-profile cases. So the next question is, does she look at the ruling and say, I'm good with that. Or does she actually appeal it? We know she's very ambitious. She's been mentioned for everything from president to Supreme Court justice to governor. Her name is on every list. And so she's probably, you know, it's likely she's making these calculations. And she can, of course, decide not to appeal the ruling and let it stand as unconstitutional. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch, how she makes the political calculus on that.
Each of you briefly, do you think this is the end of the death penalty, at least for the near future?
I think we're headed for the end of the death penalty. I think so. Bill's exactly right. It's not a hot issue anymore, and in fact, it's a little repulsive to think about it, and I think that may be the deal.
We don't have a feasible way to carry out in California if we wanted to. The voters are showing no pressure to politicians to carry it out, so I think it's going to go away.
Mm-hmm. And the recent attempts at the death penalty have been so disastrous in other states. I think
you're referring to the Arizona.
Was it Missouri? Who also? I know in our news meeting somebody said that'll be the end of the death penalty, and we said, well, I don't know if it's going to be, but it's the beginning of the end, I think.
And there have been, over the years since the 70s, California, you probably remember, Californians have voted on this three times, and the first time it passed, pro-death penalty, a ballot initiative passed by like 80%, and then it passed by 60%, and the most recent one barely passed. So clearly, it seems like voters are, you know, again, it didn't fail, so it wasn't totally there in 2012, but it does seem to be, you know, on the decline in terms of popularity in the state. And I think partly because of this process issue. It's not necessarily that everyone thinks that the death penalty is morally repugnant. They just don't see it's very useful anymore based on the system that we have in place right now.
Just by a show of hands, who is glad to see the death penalty go away? Okay, anyone wishes it were still up? A few hands. Several. Well, let's move on to some more directly political issues. And I wanted to go into immigration reform. Bill, you were writing something recently about Governor Brown going down to Mexico and making some comments about Governor Rick Perry, I believe it was. What's going into that? I mean, is this
Rick Perry, friend of the Commonwealth Club, I believe.
He is indeed came here and
Daniel opined
on things. Yes,
give him credit for showing up.
That's right.
What I wrote a column for the Sacramento Bee on this last week, and what struck me was that Governor Brown was really vocal about immigration reform in 2013. He put out a statement in January saying this is going to be the year of immigration reform. It's like George Costanza declaring the summer of George. This is going to be immigration reform. And then he said he's going to be a player in the national debate. And then come October, to his credit, he signed some very, you know, some very imaginative forwarded measures on immigration reform, giving legal immigrants driver's licenses, allowing illegal immigrants to practice law in California. Sorry, competition. And being on the cutting edge. But in 2014, while immigration sits in Washington in this netherland, he's been pretty quiet about the whole thing. And I think he needs to be taken task for this reason. He is the governor of the state with the nation's largest immigrant population. There's nothing stopping him from working with other governors around America to come up with a third-party solution, something not Democratic in Obama, not something Republican in Boehner, but a third-party solution, and go to Washington and demand the logjam be broken. But he just doesn't show any interest. And also in that column, by the way, I also dinged Neil Kashkari, the Republican candidate, because Kashkari is running as a big tent, inclusive Republican. He's the son of immigrants. This is right in his wheelhouse. He hasn't said anything about it either. And so I just don't know if these gentlemen are distracted by other issues, or maybe like a lot of other politicians, they're just perplexed with this Gordian knot that is immigration reform, and they just don't know how to address it.
Well, I was just about to ask, why do you think?
I think in
is
Brown's,
it because it's an election year? Do you think
I think in Brown's case, first of all, he probably sees this as Washington's problem to fix. Secondly, the refugees are not pouring across his border. They're pouring across the Texas border. So it's a NIMBY issue, not in my backyard. And then finally, he doesn't have competition in this race. Neil Kashkari is at least 20 points behind in the last poll I saw. He doesn't have any money in the bank. Brown has $20+ million, can raise another $20 million tomorrow if he so chooses. So it's not like the issue is breathing down his neck. Ironically, if you remember, his sister Kathleen ran for governor in 1994 against my old boss, Pete Wilson, as state treasurer, and this issue just chewed her up and spat her out. You know, she was on the other side of Proposition 187, and that was the wrong place to be in 1994. Maybe the right place to be now, but the wrong place then. So I think those are the reasons why he's just not getting into it. But again, I think, you know, he has the bully pulpit in California. and he can choose to use that bully pulpit however he chooses, be it taxes, be it high-speed rail. I think he needs to wade into this issue and get into it now.
It's a little, it seems like, the Mark Twain quote about the weather. Everybody talks about it, nobody does anything about it. Right. You know, what are we going to do about immigration? And I don't think anyone has a great idea, so it may have reached the point where it's better to leave it alone. However, the border states, it's an incredibly hot issue, and Rick Perry will bring it up every chance he gets because that's right in his wheelhouse. But here, and we have to accept, I can't remember what the number is, but the number of illegal workers in California and the United States is huge. And to take those people out of our economy would be an enormous problem and an enormous debt. So it's almost, we don't want to talk about it, but it's here, it's happening, and only something like these kids coming across the border kind of focuses the attention again. And then when we say, well, I don't know, what do you want to do about it? Because I'm not sure what to do.
We're talking about the governor. I mean, the president, has he shown leadership? I mean, last time we were here with a different panel, but we were talking about him getting dinged for, doing fundraising and not going to the border, and that, of course, gave Rick Perry a chance to talk more about that. But, is that a fair criticism of him, not leading, not using his bully pulpit?
From my perspective, I don't think he's led. What a surprise. What a shocker. The room would probably disagree. He is, let's see what he does on the executive action front, the executive order front. He has said, his people have said, that he's going to come back from his vacation. He's going to issue executive orders. And let's see if he indeed does this or if this is a red line moment where he doesn't quite follow through on the threat slash promise. You just wish that Washington were more adult about the situation. It were simple. Maybe it's simple in movies, but not in real life. But the president could just call down a half a dozen leaders from Congress, both sides of the aisle, and sit down and say, okay, fellas, how are we going to go about this? And put all the components into play. Because it is a Gordian knot, but when you start to unravel it, there are basic components to it. You have children on the border. What do we do with the children? You have people coming in who are not children necessarily, or they're not children from Central America, from Mexico. Are they considered the same, or are they considered differently? There is a question of how they get across the border, which gets into border security. There's a question of what you do with people here. There's a question of public services. Yeah, it's formidable and you tangle all together, but when you actually start unraveling it, you just do it bit by bit.
And one of the ironies, we were talking about this before, but when Boehner began this lawsuit thing, one of the first things that, as I said, is Obama went to the Rose Garden and started issuing executive orders. And one of his first ones was, I'm going to come back on immigration because the Republicans are doing nothing about this. So he has an opportunity to make hay with this very volatile issue and say, and I don't know what his executive order will be, but it's going to be very difficult to solve the problem in an executive order. But he'll be able to say, well, I did this. The Republicans are still arguing about what they want to, how they want to approach this. So it's, unfortunately, it's kind of kabuki theater. You know, it's a stage show.
Well, Congress is going on a recess for 5 weeks, so we can guarantee that nothing is going, no, more nothing.
The public will be safe.
It's gonna be happening in Washington, D.C. for at least the next little while. So maybe it'll leave the president opening to do some executive ordering, and maybe the Republicans can go home and write more lawsuits to sue him for those executive orders. But we can be sure, I mean, sadly, it doesn't look like anything is going to change in the near future. The president is really limited in what he can do by executive order,
Right. Okay. Technically.
Well,
one of the things the president is doing is, as I hinted, doing a lot of fundraising. The Washington Post reported a couple days ago, quote, this year alone, Obama has attended 40 fundraisers and has hosted nearly 400 events during his whole time in office. And Michelle Obama has been hitting the fundraising circuit as well. In Chicago on Friday, the First Lady urged the assembled supporters to, quote, write a big fat check, unquote, to ensure the Democrats have the best chance to do well in the midterms. Just a day earlier, she admitted, quote, there's too much money in politics, unquote. So certainly both parties are playing that game. But Bill, all these fundraisers and what we hear about them is usually that the president has gone in somewhere and had a fundraiser and maybe how much money is raised. Unless there's a 47% video that comes out of it, we usually don't know what happens in them, do we?
The press invariably, no offense, Chuck, but the press complain about this, but probably doesn't care about the press complaining about these things. It's at least the president's worry, the press complaining about getting access. I'm going to throw a curveball at you. I don't have a problem with the president raising money. It's what presidents do. And what's the alternative? You not raise money and his party be at a financial disadvantage? So he is playing by the rules. The criticism I would have is this, and you probably, if you've heard me here before, I say this almost every time I come here, so feel free to fall asleep for 30 seconds. The president comes to San Francisco, and he doesn't show the city, the area, much in the way of public policy attention. They make up an event. They go to a Walmart down on the peninsula or something like that. He doesn't go over to Oakland, where there is just hell on the streets of Oakland. And he is the nation's first black president, is uniquely suited to go into that city and offer some leadership and some vision. But he doesn't do that. He just comes and he takes the money and he runs. I don't have a problem with him raising money if he'd spend a little more time around and also talk policy as well.
Personally, I'm shocked to hear that he's raising all this money. That's astonishing to me. I can't believe it. No, that's
thank you, Captain Renault.
Thank you, Captain Renault. No, it's the mother's milk of politics. But Chronicle columnist Willie Brown called him out on the same thing, and I think that's exactly right. Is that if there's a, we were so excited, many of us were so excited when Obama was elected because he made such a connection. Those speeches were excellent. But the thing that he hasn't done is make that connection that Bill Clinton made, or the personal connection. He seems a little aloof. He seems a little standoffish. And it would go miles if he were to appear at a daycare center in Oakland or someplace like that. It would be terrific. It'd be a great press opportunity. It'd be a photo op. It'd be good for him. It'd be good for San Francisco and the Bay Area. It'd be good for the country.
And then
it's not
evening,
that hard.
In the evening, then he can appear at the Commonwealth Club. I think that would, everyone, it's a win-win.
Right here.
No one can dispute from it. Someone actually put in this card asking about this, and we've certainly been talking about it before this program, and that is something called Six Californias. You know, we've chatted about this in the past. Tim Draper, a wealthy venture capitalist, have you ever met a poor one, has talked about his program here, his plan here while at the Commonwealth Club. I suggest you track down his audio and video from our website. But so, Bill, let's start with you. What do you think of this plan?
God, where do we start? How much time do we have? Short story, Tim Draper wants to split California into six parts. Sitting here in San Francisco, you would be part of a state called Silicon Valley. Right.
Aren't we?
Right on. Maybe just ought to call it Draper Stan instead. North California, Central California, East California, South California, six parts. You could talk about the politics of it. It's a horrible thing to happen to Democrats because Republicans would walk away with up to 28 electoral votes. Goodbye 55 in the bag for Democrats every 4 years. I don't know how this particular state would manage because it would be the wealthiest state in America per capita income. But guess what? You'd have to buy your water and electricity elsewhere. And I got a feeling that poor Northern California would offer it to you at some decidedly interesting prices. So there are a lot of curious little ways that this worked. But I think the fundamental problem with this is that as long as this land has been a state, there have been efforts to try to chop it up, usually north-south. You cut it around the Tehachapi Pass down in Los Angeles. But the state has stayed together. And at a time when politics are difficult, when it's hard to get people united on subjects, what could be more divisive than trying to chop us up into six different parts? That said, Mr. Draper is very clever in what he's doing. He took his time collecting signatures and turning them in. He just missed the 2014 deadline, so now it qualifies for the November 2016 ballot, which means that you'll have 2+ years to hear about the virtues of six Californias.
There are, in addition to all that, there are a couple of major, like, let's even assume that this passes. It's 2016. We've all been brainwashed into thinking that this is a great idea, and we pass it. At that point, it then goes to Congress, and then they have to agree to give us additional Senate seats. And
actually, before that, this is a lawyer's field day because there is a question about applying for statehood, if a cut-up state can apply for statehood, because the Constitution says it has to be approved by state legislatures. So the first legal threshold is, does an initiative vote equal state legislature?
Yeah, who's the state legislature? The idea that anything will happen in Washington, D.C., much less this, is really far-fetched. That's assuming we vote for it. I will say this, though. What he's tapped into is very interesting, and let me give you a recent example. So State Senator Mark Leno created a piece of legislation that would make it more difficult to Ellis Act people out of their homes. And it would do things like require someone, if you purchase an apartment building, you would have to hold it for at least 5 years before you start Ellis Acting people, things like that. It was some protections. He made it so that it only applied to San Francisco. And it didn't even apply anywhere else. And it died in committee. Why? Because even by the vote of five people, including two Democrats, because the Democrats who lived in Southern California, in places where they don't have to worry about Ellis Acts and sort of urban issues that we have, those folks don't care. And there was a lot of influence exercised by real estate interests. And so they were able to, and there was nobody in their district who was going to care about like whether San Francisco could Ellis Act or anything like that. And that's just an example of something that's a priority for us that is not a priority for other people in the state. And so our interests weren't realized in that instance. And so what he's tapping into, and I think what we'll be hearing more about, and it's something that we should consider. I'm not saying we should consider six states, but I'm saying we should consider the extent to which we have to go to a state legislature which is not necessarily interested in the same stuff that we are as an urban area. And is what can we do? Are there other ways we can get around this and be more self-regulating than we are currently? Again, the Ellis Act thing is just an example. I'll also add, it's 220 attempts to split the state of California already.
Really?
This is 221.
Wow.
It's the charm, as they say. So, assuming we vote for it. But again, I think the questions that are raised are important.
Right. And I would like to begin with an apology. I was on this panel about, I would say, 6 months ago, and we were talking about how we're sending everything to the ballot box. Yeah. Everything. We, the government makes all, we elect people, they're competent people, they're competent and skilled in their fields, they make informed decisions, and then we say, forget that, we're going to go to the ballot box. And Melissa said, I think this is a bad idea. And I said, oh, come on, let's let the people talk about it. I apologize, you were right.
You getting this, camera?
Okay. Oh, there is, I don't know if it's a movement or a feeling or whatever it is, the let the people decide idea has kind of taken over. And we're seeing it in San Francisco. We're seeing it here. There's no way we're going to split the state into six different sections. And yet, we're going to go through an election to do it. And legitimately, the legislature could have looked at this and said, it's not feasible. Look at all the problems that Bill and Melissa have mentioned already. It's not feasible. We can't do that. But that's not what we want to hear now. We want to be empowered. We want to go to the people. What's wrong with let the people decide? Well, behold the beast.
Yeah, I would guess, by the way, by the 2 years from now, by the time this is kicked around, I think after Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart and others have just played with it like a dog and a chew toy, it'll be treated like the quintessential California goofy thing. And sadly, that's what the recall became also. The recall in 2003 was supposed to be a serious discussion about what was wrong with California, and instead it became great political theater, and great for people like us to talk about, but not really a serious discussion it was. One thing I will say about the Draper Initiative is this. If you go back to 1966 and move forward, almost every decade, California vents some way politically. Reagan in 66, Prop 13 in 1978, the Rose Byrd recall in 1986, Prop 187 and Prop 209 in the 90s, the recall last decade. So about every 10 to 12 years, there is a venting of frustration of sorts, which, why Draper's initiative probably will not pass, I would not rule it out as completely ridiculous either. There are some frustrations that he's tapping into.
Well, as you've mentioned, Bill, this past Sunday, marked 100 days to Election Day. So we're now 99 days to Election Day. And I thought it would be a good time to kind of check in and get your take on how the two major parties, you can throw in some other parties if you wish, are doing. And if you will, let's talk, say, because I think their performance is probably going to vary, say the Republicans in California, and then separately handle the Republicans nationally. And then again, Democrats in California, Democrats nationally. So, Bill, why don't we start with you, since you kind of were the germ of this idea.
Republicans in California nationally.
Let's start with Republicans in California.
This would be like the Thurston Hell, the third vodka martini, which is a moment of silence for the vermouth. The Republicans are best looked at like a baseball franchise that is in a very slow rebuild. And you're not going to go to the playoffs this year. You ain't going to go next year. You ain't going to go in 2 years. It's about a four-year grind. And that's the GOP reality. Republicans would probably be thrilled if Neel Kashkari got 40%. That's setting a bar very low, but 40% would mean not a meltdown below the ticket. They would be thrilled if they could win one statewide race, which would be state controller, and they would be over the moon if they could hold their own and maybe pick up a single or maybe two House seats as well as some state legislative seats as well. This is all in the theater of low expectations, but when you're at a party that's at 29% and sinking, when you think about this, they don't have a national avatar. This is the last successful national avatar for Republicans to point to as far as California, would be Ronald Reagan, who's been off the stage since 1988, not with us for 10 years this summer. It's a party that's challenged on about every front. So the bar is set low, and that could not be in greater contrast with what's going on around the nation. The Republicans, the party of Congress that I mentioned, is actually lined up in a way which, from a Republican perspective, in which we've sort of mastered the ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory the last couple cycles, the Republicans have sort of drawn an inside straight in this election in terms of where the Senate seats are. They're all in very small red states that play very well to Republicans. They've managed to avoid a lot of circular firing squads in their primaries, but not putting out fatally flawed candidates who believe in life on Mars and that rape is a pleasurable thing and all sorts of great theories like that.
Progress,
hope. The New York Times and the Washington Post have little election machines that they run. They crunch data and they come out with predictions. The Washington Post gives the Republicans, I think, a 69%, 70% chance of getting the Senate. The New York Times today came out with theirs. They give it a 60% chance, and that means picking up six seats and getting 51 seats in the Senate. So 100 days out, things actually line up pretty well for the Republicans, but I caution you that is 14 weeks from tomorrow, and things can change.
Melissa, the GOP.
Well, it's interesting. In California, you see the GOP shrinking, but you don't see the Democratic Party growing. Right, people are going to decline to state. Decline to state keeps growing, Republicans keep shrinking. That's kind of where the pie goes. Democrats are kind of stuck at around 44%. And they haven't really gained much ground as Republicans have been shrinking. So what you have here now is an opportunity for Republicans to reach out to these decline to state people and see kind of where they are politically, right? Are these disenfranchised Republicans who just wish they were more socially liberal? Which, by the way, I think all of the Republican candidates in statewide office at least say that they are. So they're not playing up social issues like, gay marriage and pro-choice, things like that. They're all sticking to jobs and fiscal issues. To the extent that they're on the record on social issues, they tend to be more moderate, if not downright socially liberal. So this is an interesting test case to see. I mean, Republicans, and again, remember after 2012, they released this big study saying, path to victory, they put together a study saying, here's how we messed up in 2012, and that said a lot of things. And it said, you have to reach out to the immigrant population, you have to reach out to women, you have to be more inclusive, be more big tent, and now that's kind of what we have. Again, give or take with all these candidates. So this is, I think Republicans in other places are going to be watching our elections to see if, how well they do. Because this is again, sort of what people have been, and consultants have been telling them, they're supposed to be doing. And then there's this other strain in the Republican Party that says, no, we just have to get out the vote better and double down on our values. So these two competing ideologies are really playing out right here in California. And so who takes and how much of the decline to state vote they take is going to be really, really important to Republicans and other blue states as they try to gain some ground.
That was good. In California, both parties are governed, I think, by one person, and that is Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown is, in some ways, the most interesting man in the world because he does not care about any of this stuff. He's been there. He's done it. He came to our Ed Board meeting, and we have a new president of the Chronicle, and she had never seen Jerry Brown. And she walked out of that room with her jaw. High-speed rail? Sure, we're going to do high-speed rail. Is it popular? No, but we're going to do it anyway. It doesn't matter. I'm Jerry Brown. We're going to do it. And nobody, Kashkari, the Republicans, no one has a good answer to him. And frankly, Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris are sitting around biding their time. When will he be off the stage? But he is dominating the picture. But in some ways, he's also stalemating, I think. He's not someone he talks about, maybe I will run for president, but he doesn't have his eye on bigger things. He's here and now, and that's what he's doing. He gets nothing but reinforcement for it. He says whatever he wants. He really doesn't care. And that's a fascinating dynamic for politics when there's so much calculus going on. If I say this, what will that mean for the... He doesn't care. He really doesn't care. He quoted Latin. He went from the Jesuit education. He went off on tangents. It was fascinating, you know. And then you have to remind. And this is the governor, right? This is the governor of the state of California. But that, to me, is that's where California is with this very interesting, quirky guy who's kind of dominating the political scene.
It is, and if I were a Democrat down the ticket, I would be absolutely frustrated by this.
Exactly.
Because you have Republicans running locally and statewide who are trying their best to rebrand the GOP in California. They're trying their best to avoid social conservative issues, all those various topics that have put Republicans at 29% and sinking. If you're a congressional Democrat, if you're a state legislative Democrat, you sorely want this to be a values discussion in California. You don't want to talk about the economy or education. You want to talk about values, plain and simple. You want to make your Republican opponent choose if they're in the tent or outside of the tent, which it is. So you need the governor with his $20-plus million to run ads challenging his opponent and challenging Republicans to where they stand. As it is right now, the governor, who is the cheapest man in town in Sacramento, has spent, I think, all of $200,000 on his campaign so far, which is about what it is to pay a couple consultants to keep the lights on, and that's about it. In fact, if you go on his campaign website, I think there's one press release from 2012, and then the rest are attacking Meg Whitman. So doesn't have to worry. By the way, I'll give you an idea of just how one-sided this race is. A reporter told me the other day that a prominent Democrat, didn't say which one, actually ran several questions about Jerry Brown, one of which was, if it was revealed the governor was suffering from Alzheimer's before the election, would you still vote for him? Numbers didn't move. Well, I safely say if he passed away a week before the election, he would win. But the point is that you want this values discussion in California to make life uncomfortable for Republicans, and what it appears the governor's going to do is he's going to run some very easy, simple, basic ads just talking about, you know, came, I saw, I conquered, I made good on my promises in 2010, four more years. He's not going to push the debate in that direction. And in doing that, he's harming his party's chances to make gains where they could.
I actually had a long conversation with Gavin Newsom right before the primary. And Newsom, you know, it was not in any danger in the primary. He was going to be the top vote getter for the lieutenant governor. But even at that, he saw Jerry at one point and said, you know, what kinds of things are you doing in the build up to the primary here? And he said, well, we went river rafting last weekend. And he was like, you're kidding, you've got an election. He said, I know, but we went on a raft. It was great. We were up in the Russian River. It was a lot of fun. You know, that's the kind of, he feels like he's untouchable, but he's not advancing the ball. I mean, I think isn't that the deal? He's Jerry Brown. That's who he is, and that's what you're going to get.
Well, and when we talked earlier about why he isn't doing more on immigration, he doesn't have to. Right. You know, that's messy and a lot of work. You know, coming up with the third way and going to Washington and saying, I represent the ninth largest economy in the world. And why? Go rafting. You know, you don't need to. You've done enough. You've issued licenses. You've appointed, immigrants to the Supreme Court. You know, he's got it in the bag. Like, there's no need to wade in to the murky waters of immigration policy at this point. So, yeah.
Well, this will take us is 4 years from now, 2018. We're going to have a open governor's race, unless Governor Brown finds a way to undo term limits for now and then. Don't count him out. And unless Dianne Feinstein decides to run for re-election at the age of 85.
She might.
And she might. Don't count her out.
I do.
She's already the oldest senator, by the way. In fact, she doesn't like it when I publish that, but she is. We will have two big open seats. Big because one is a job to have for 8 years, and as Feinstein and Boxer have shown, they're both in their 22nd years in the Senate. And the line forms at the rear of, it's like watching planes circling around SFO on a foggy day. The line forms at the rear of Democrats who aspire for this. And it's Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris and Mayor Garcetti in Los Angeles and Mayor Villaraigosa would probably like to make a comeback and Tom Steyer here in San Francisco and Democrats to be named later. So the party's going to have to sort out who goes where, and part of that's going to be a discussion about where Democrats in California are headed and a lot of these sort of progressive pressure which has been building up during the Brown years.
Well, if there were six Californias, they could all be governor.
You just made Tim Draper's case.
Okay. Briefly, before we move on, Democrats nationally. Chuck, it's going to be a rough year for them.
It has. I mean, the Republicans are doing a good job of making it a rough year for them. They're obstructionists, and they want to make it as difficult as possible. This lawsuit is a good example of that. But the Democrats have not been very sure-footed on what they want to do. Pick something and stick with it. What is it going to be? When Obama was reelected, immigration was going to be something that they had to have, and they felt they had the support of the Republicans because they were going to have the support. They had no minority support. This would be a great thing for them to do. It looked like a come-together moment. None of it has happened. So in their own way, the Democrats have contributed as much as anyone to stalemate in Washington, stalemate nationally, and if there's one poll that we've seen over and over, it's how intensely frustrated people are with government in Washington. And you know, both parties are to blame for that.
Okay. Melissa, briefly, Democrats nationally.
Well, one of the frustrating things about this whole debate over whether Obama should have been fundraising when, you know, the sort of the world is ending, it seems like, with problems all around the globe, is that he was fundraising for the House of Representatives, for Democrats running for Congress. And it was like,
so he was helping the poor. And
well,
other
yeah. I mean, it was like, this is just such a lost cause. Why are you, you know, of all the things to be doing right now, there's 0.0% chance. I mean, at least in this, if it was a Senate race, maybe, okay, that would be sort of seen as fighting the good fight. But yeah, it looks very, very bleak. Having said that, it still looks like, for what it's worth, that Democrats are still poised pretty well to stay in the White House. But when it comes to, you know, the Senate and Congress, you know, there, and to your point, Chuck, the part of the problem is there doesn't seem to be much of a vision. There doesn't seem to be. There was a great article in The Guardian a few years ago, and it was written by a psychologist. And he's also a political scientist sort of slash psychologist. And he said, the title of it was, why do poor people vote Republican? You know, and the whole thing was like, why do they vote against what seems maybe to be in their, you know, against their own self-interest? And he said, because there's a vision, like, you know what they stand for. They give you a sort of line of sight for what a world in their eyes would look like. And he said, Democrats don't do that. You run, you know, he said, the idea of, you know, taking care of this person or this person isn't real. That's not a vision. I mean, it's okay, but Democrats still haven't seemed to be able to put that narrative together yet. And maybe they will closer to a presidential year. But right now, to your point, they're don't get me wrong. The Republicans don't have it like that much together. But the Democrats are really floundering in that regard. So, you know, hopefully they can come up with a better narrative.
Okay, Bill, last word.
Well, the Democrats lesson here might be that the best thing for a party is to go out in the woods for a few years and go out and discover your soul and spend your time beating up on the presidents in the White House and the leadership in the Congress and use that opportunity to try to rediscover yourself. And maybe that's what's going to happen to the Democrats between 2014 and 2016. And keep in mind, while 2014 looks like heady days for Republicans in Senate races, it swings just the opposite way in 2016. It's lined up poorly for Republicans then. So Republicans, if they do get majority control of Congress, I've been advocating this for months now, they should be running right now with the Contract of America, like the House Republicans did in 1994. They should be laying out what ideas they're running on, what they plan to implement in Congress, so that they'd have a vision both to offer voters, but more importantly, when they actually get control of the Senate, they're actually on the hook to do things within 100 days, because the biggest challenge is when you take over the Congress, it's like the peasants taking over the Tsar's palace in 1917, chaos breaks out. And you have to keep Ted Cruz at bay. You have to keep the worst instincts of the Senate Republicans and just keep focused on your job. And so that's, we'll see if Republicans can actually govern it if they get the chance.
Okay. Well, let's try to get through a number of these questions, cards that have been put in. I'm going to actually start with one who is praising you, Melissa, and actually thinks that I was perhaps insulting you before when I was talking about our graduate course here, which certainly is not the case. You know,
thank
me
you,
and Melissa, I have nothing but the highest respect for her.
Was that signed Christopher Kane?
Yes, I'm just curious. It has been.
Stop picking on my wife. Someone asked, what is the impact of a majority of voters voting before Election Day? And Larry Gersten of San Jose State University has said it's actually a majority, quite a strong majority, who will have voted before. Bill, let's start. I mean, any sense of, does that sway things, or does that mean those late election, you know,
I would say see Yi comma Leland. He finished, what, third in the controllers race, I believe. A mutual friend of ours on this panel, Dan Schnur, ran as Dan's a former Republican operative. He's now an academic at USC, and he ran just about the ultimate good government campaign against fundraising and transparency in government and so forth, and he was nowhere to be found. Meanwhile, the gentleman alleged of doing a lot of horrible things finished third. So I think part of the problem there is people are voting early and not thinking through the ballots the way they should. And that to me is the ultimate problem with early voting, if something happens shortly before the election and you just don't know about it. So,
well, what I just was talking to John Ernst the other day about, he's the San Francisco director of elections, and one of the problems is not not only are they voting by mail, but many people vote by mail on the day of the election. So you end up with an onslaught of ballots that are coming in all at once. And the other thing that we heard a lot, that newspapers are hearing, and I'll bet politicians are hearing, is, boy, I wish I'd read your editorial before I voted. You know, typically we run an editorial about the election the week before the election. And many of these people have already filled out their ballot two weeks, 3 weeks before that. And we heard that a lot, seriously, just in the local elections. Boy, that made a lot of sense. I wish I'd known that before I marked my ballot. Well, it's too late now. So I think it's a sea change. It's over 50% now.
Oh, yeah.
And going up. I mean, it's definitely the wave of the future. What do we do in terms of politics? What do we do in terms of our coverage? What do we do in terms of voters and counting votes?
Political consultants love this, by the way, because it means that they're, you know, that the point at which they have to be fully engaged and deploying door hangers and advertising and all of these things that you would normally do, like around 6 weeks before Election Day, now you have to do 3 months before Election Day. So that's a lot more money. That requires a lot more people. But also for those of us who don't necessarily do that, and even for those who do vote early, you then get really fatigued, right? Because the campaigns are just hammering you. And the reason they are is because every day is an Election Day for that 30 days leading up to real Election Day. So it can be frustrating even for regular folks to have to just constantly be getting stuff in the mail and seeing things on television. And so it causes a little fatigue. But again, political consultants love this. I have consistently advocated for a Saturday voting day, polling day. It's ridiculous that we're still voting on Tuesday. It's like a business day, as if it's ye old, you know, let's get in our horse and buggy and go to town. It's absolutely absurd. I think that would really help maybe alleviate a lot of the pressure. And the reason why the people vote, so many people vote so early, is because they don't have time necessarily on polling day to make that trip. So, you know, I think we could do some reforms that maybe alleviate a little bit of that, but until then, it's just going to be 30 days of Election Day for all of us.
One of our audience members is referring to our first topic of the GOP lawsuit against the president, talk of impeachment. The person writes, I am being emailed daily by the DCCC, the Democratic campaign...
Congressional
campaign. Thank you.
For
donations to help fight this issue, the suing or impeachment of Obama. I love him, but it doesn't make any sense to throw money at such stupidity on both sides. I think this person speaks for a lot of folks, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is not something we discussed, but if anyone has a view on this, according to the New York Times, 40% of babies born in the U.S. have single mothers, and divorce rate in the U.S. is getting higher. So could you talk about marriage in San Francisco or California and the policy related to it? I wonder if that kind of is something, I mean, you're talking about, you know, Democrats hoping they'll be able to talk social issues to bring the Republicans out on issues they don't want to talk about. But at the same time, this is someone saying, hey, those are actually serious issues to talk about.
Not married, no children, a lot of friends who are single mothers, both by choice, circumstance, necessity. I pass.
Fair enough.
Seriously think it's just a topic I don't want to wade to. I think it's, you know, Republicans have done a horrible job of judging single women over the years. It's not fair. Not every woman chooses to be a single mother. Sometimes life works out that way. You don't find your mate, or you get out of a bad marriage or bad relationship. So, again, so I said I would say nothing, now I've said something, so now I will say nothing.
Well, next year, married 30 years, just a dumb luck on the whole process. Thank you very much. But my kids are now 27 and 22, and each of them at different times individually has said, you know, I never realized how great it was that you guys have been together this whole time. That so many of my friends come from broken homes. And there's a million different factors, women making enough money that they don't have to stay in a marriage that's a problem, people who decide not to get married, single mothers who want to have a child but don't feel they have to wait, same-sex marriage. It's changed the landscape. And I think that's one of the things that is difficult for people to go back and advocate traditional values. In some cases, what are they? What are those traditional values? Is it a man and a woman and a child? It may not be. And I think it's a very good thing. I think it's great. But it does kind of throw things into confusion.
Well, I guess not.
if you care to say.
Oh, boy. No. Here's the thing. It has become the case. I get tired of hearing about the women vote because women vote more than men. And so I really look forward to the day when we can have a conversation about how do you get out the man vote? You know, women are voting. We're already there. We're already the majority most times. So, and I like the fact that that it's finally driving the narrative, that people are actually, you know, making ads and you know, even doing weird political manipulations to get women out to vote or to appeal to women. And so, you know, I think that that's an important tide shift. And whether they're single or even married, the idea that we're talking more about flexible work schedules and we're talking more about, you know, child care tax credits and things like that is better for everybody, but it at least reflects a recognition that women are an extremely valuable voting bloc that, again, is becoming more and more dominant.
Question.
Yeah.
If Hillary is a nominee in 2016.
Yes.
Does she run a campaign parallel to that of Obama's in terms of targeting certain women's groups and playing the gender gap? Because Obama won in 2012. With the widest gender gap in presidential history. It was mm-hmm. about 20 points, I believe. I think it was plus 12 among women and minus 8 mm-hmm. among men, 20-point difference, never larger. Does she basically mimic what Obama did, or given her gender, does that just magnify the women's vote and the
you see, you mean, how hard does she try?
How hard does she try, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting thing to watch. How do you walk that line? You don't right. want to stand up. I was at the Democratic State Convention when Mark Leno challenged Carol Migdon for her Senate seat, right? So it's a Democratic State Convention. They're figuring out who the Democratic Party is going to endorse for this Senate seat. And it was a big deal, just crazy people running around, petitions and things like that. It was great. It was nerdy, nerdy fun. But so when they got up to give their speeches to, you know, to sort of advocate for their campaign, Carol Migdon got up and said, this is her entire speech, was I'm a woman. I'm a woman. I am a woman, I am a woman. And it was like, what? Is that it? Is that
W-O-M-N-N.
This is it? I know, right? How many times? Okay, like that was the entire speech. And I'm not even exaggerating when I say this. That was literally, it was just like iterations of that statement. And it was really, I think, offensive to a lot of people in there. I didn't have a right to vote, so it didn't matter to me. But I think a lot of women in there were really sort of taken aback by, you know, the notion that, is that all you have to say? So you want to emphasize and capitalize on it as an asset,
right.
but you do risk going too far and making that sort of a pillar. Women want, people want real solutions to their real problems, not just you know, a woman in the White House, which would be cool, but not just any woman, right? So you know, how she threads that needle is going to be fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say something that might be, we can just erase this, right? If it,
sure.
if it doesn't come out right, it'll be fine.
There's no tape.
Nobody will remember. She also has to be liked by women. And I'm not sure in some ways that Hillary Clinton is. She's a very tough cookie. I mean, a lot of people like that about her. I don't know. I'm a big Fresh Air Terry Gross fan. And I don't know how many people heard it, but Hillary Clinton was on that show and got very abrupt with our Terry Gross. I mean, Terry Gross, who gets huffy with Terry Gross, for heaven's sake? But she was pushing her and asking her some questions about her stance on same-sex marriage. And she said, I'm just trying to understand what you're doing. And Hillary Clinton said, you know, I don't think that is what you're doing. I think what you're doing is trying to put in, and it was a, you could see the handlers going, whoa, 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 whoa. No.
She had the same exchange with Charlie Rose a couple weeks ago. The first question he asked was, what's your greatest accomplishment as Secretary of State? And she's bristled and said, you know, what kind of question are you asking me?
Yes.
She thought it was a gotcha question.
Yes.
And this is pretty easy stuff.
Right. And it's not a woman issue. It's a person issue. And I think that you want to like that person. If you're going to vote for that person to be the leader of your country, you'd like to like that person. And she's got some rough edges. And the fact that she's a woman may not be enough to carry the day, just as Melissa's saying. I think that's a very good point. So if that's politically incorrect, let's erase that. But if it's not, I mean, I think there's a real possibility. You still have to be a good candidate. You have to be a good representative. And you have to be someone that people trust and like.
On that note, let's move to our news quiz. I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, please raise your hand. I'll call you. And you can shout out the answer. Winners will receive a little chocolatey prize from our Santa Colette. So, The first question is, France today offered asylum to Christians who were forced out by Islamic State militants from their homes where? I want the city, if you know the city where they're being forced out. Sir, I saw you first. Sorry? That's right, Mosul in Iraq. Very good. Next question. Let's see how you are in your international business news. Can you name the oil giant whose shareholders just won a $50 billion arbitration ruling against the Russian government? Did you see this? Way in the back there, sir. Yukos, very good. You people read the news or watch the news or follow Twitter, I don't know. Okay, so what conservative personality announced plans this week, I believe it's already gone live, to launch their own television channel? Ma'am.
Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin, that's right. In the red there. You'll want to write this down so you can sign up. It's called the Sarah Palin Channel, and you pay $9.95 a month or $99.95 a year. It's a deal. But after 2 years, she quits, I think, right? Okay, so... Next question. Where did former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg fly to protest a flight ban? Ma'am, I saw you first. Sorry?
Tel Aviv,
Israel. That's correct. How many days a week does billionaire Carlos Slim think you should work?
Three.
Three is right. His plan is that people will work three longer days, work days, and then have later retirement. What happened to the 2,800-year-old tomb of the biblical Jonah? Did anyone see? In back there in the light? That's right. It was blown up by ISIS, or the Islamic State, as they're known in Iraq, when they're not busy, I guess, chasing the Christians out of Mosul. Here's another business news question. What company is buying online real estate research firm Trulia? Sir? Zillow, that's right. They're actually buying it for $3.5 billion, which is about how much it costs to buy a house in San Francisco, so it's a good deal. There's a Korean baseball team called, I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Hanwha Eagles. They have lost more than 400 games in the past decade, but they have a new way to boost attendance. Who is sitting in their stands or bleachers? Anyone see this? Maybe I should ask this. I should say, who or what is sitting in the stands for the Hanwha Eagles? Anyone want to guess? Is there, sir?
I believe these are just puppets. They have a screen, so you can put your own picture on it, and you will see sitting in
the... They are, in fact, robots. So, yes. In fact, you can control it from your smartphone. I assume they all short-circuit when there's a rain delay. I don't know. But.
Oh, my God.
What is the latest state to have its same-sex marriage ban struck down by a court?
Virginia.
Someone raise your hand. In Virginia? Who said that? Ma'am in the red. And one last question. Liberia closed most of its border crossings as it's trying to contain an outbreak of what? Sir.
Ebola
virus. That's right. It's apparently the worst one on record. Well, for our final week-to-week program this summer, we will have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss in 2 weeks on the evening of Monday. Thank you. Monday, August 11th, when we return for our next program. Thank you to our panel, Melissa Griffin-Kane, C.W. Nevius, and Bill Whalen. Thanks to all of you for being here tonight and everyone watching us on TV or listening to us online. Have a great week, everybody.